Observing with approval the house martins breeding on Macbeth's castle, shares this with Duncan. This guest of summer, the temple-haunting martlet, does approve by his loved mansionry that the heaven's breath smells wooingly here. No jutty, frieze, buttress, nor coign of vantage, but this bird hath made his pendant bed and procreant cradle. Where they most breed and haunt, I have observed, the air is delicate. Of course the air proves anything but delicate for Duncan, but our observation of the lives of birds and our readiness to read across into our own lives has a rich history. When Lady Macbeth had earlier remarked that the raven himself, his horse, that croaks the fatal entrance of Duncan, she ascribes to the bird itself insight into Duncan's fate. We might say that this is a commonplace way of talking about birds. Thomas Nagel's 1974 paper, What Is It Like to Be a Bat?, in asking us to look at the world through another's eyes, critically examines this activity. Even characterizing in brief the import of Nagel's paper about the subjective character of experience, of course, gives the game away. Using a visual metaphor confirms how strongly the senses we possess shape our world. We're going to explore here what it is like to be a bird, or more particularly, certain species of birds, and what that might tell us about being human. This enterprise is, as we hope you will agree, interesting in its own right. But we will also argue that the exercise can serve us in other ways, in particular, allowing us to engage with, and in some way, further develop an understanding of traditional Kantian transcendental idealism in Schopenhauer's synthesis from his world as will and representation. Birds are familiar to all of us. That very familiarity prevents us from appreciating some striking features of their lives. We might use the air to travel from place to place, and birds do too. But many species inhabit the air in a way that is hard to appreciate from simple observation. Common swifts, for example, feed, copulate, and sleep on the wing. The swift you see arriving in Scotland in early May has been on the wing since it left its nest the previous July. Apart from incubating eggs or feeding young in the nest, it does not use any solid substrate at all. The air is its habitat. We need to appreciate that this means that the air, the atmosphere, provides its food, such as aerial plankton, insects, and spiders, too inconspicuous to see without the aid of scientific instruments, provide all of its nutritional needs. Perhaps we should consider air quality in a different way. Should we ask how rich in biodiversity a given cubic meter of atmosphere might be as a way of assessing the quality of the common swift's habitat? This is a habitat that is shared with other species of bird. In Britain, barn swallows, house martins, and sand martins all exploit the air in this way, spending their lives to a greater or lesser extent on the wing. If we try to reflect on what this might be like, we have a range of difficulties to overcome at the very least. These species' dazzling flight speeds, allied with almost miraculous ability to maneuver in confined spaces, exhausts the imagination. And for the common swift and house martin, roosting, sleeping on the wing, we struggle to understand how they can remain forever active. Here we are imagining ourselves with a recognizingly human point of view, entering into that world. Is that what is needed for seeing as another? We will return to that, but it does illustrate in a simple way what we will call difference, and isolating and illuminating that difference is a key part of what we need to do here. Let's take a more challenging example, that of migration. Many species of bird migrate. In the Northern Hemisphere, for example, a common bird like the willow warbler breeds in temperate zones and migrates to spend the winter in Africa. Ringing recoveries show that the willow warbler, a bird with a wing length of around 6.5 millimeters. It's good there's a proper ornithologist. weighing no more than 8 or 9 grams, may travel around 4,380 kilometers from its breeding site in Kippo in the East Nook of Fife, to Mauritania, where it overwinters. How does it do this? How does it find its way? The latest research indicates that certain species of bird are able to recognize and respond to variations in the Earth's magnetic field. The willow warbler, migrating under cover of darkness, senses and responds to what is to us an invisible force field with astonishing accuracy. It is quite commonplace, for example, to catch and ring a long-distance migrant like a willow warbler in wet scrub, and for the same bird to be re-caught a year later in exactly the same place, having traveled to East Central Africa and back in the meantime. So we might say that we no longer need to use a bat as an example of an animal that has senses we do not possess. We know now that other vertebrate families make use of capacities we do not share and possess data we are unable to sense. But even when we are on familiar ground, our ability to think this through from the inside is brought up short. Consider another trans-Saharan migrant, the black cap. Slightly larger than a willow warbler, just slightly, this UK breeder also winters in subtropical and tropical Africa. While breeding, it may weigh about 17 grams, but when fueling for migration, fat deposits are accumulated and migrant birds may weigh as much as 25 grams. This process is facilitated by a switch in diet from invertebrates to fruits, such as elderberries. Imagine preparing for your trip south by eating voraciously and gaining half as much weight again, yet still being able to perform physically at your peak. While we share physiological capacities and abilities in broad terms, when we look at this in fine grain, can we really be confident that we do share that bird's eye view? Migration is a really interesting area where much recent work is causing us to reevaluate apparently well-supported assumptions. The migration of bar-tailed godwit is a startling instance. This wader, breeding over much of the northern hemisphere, can be classified into a number of different subspecies. The population that breeds in Alaska winters in Australia. While ringing has allowed its wintering range to be identified, until the recent advent of satellite tracking technology, there was uncertainty as to its migration route and the duration of the journey. Remarkably, it now seems that the birds travel nonstop over the Pacific Ocean, traveling approximately 11,000 kilometers in a journey of around 7 days, making it probably the longest nonstop journey of any bird. Besides simple astonishment, this example again illustrates how a process that we feel we do understand, endurance exercise, perhaps, takes place in terms which seem to be well outside what might be possible for us. This should, at the very least, make us pause and reflect on what we are doing when we consider the world from a bird's point of view. How confident can we be that the process we engage in is at all appropriate? Our use of analogy here dominates when we undertake this activity. In simple terms, we take a familiar activity as seen from the inside by us as a subject and posit ourselves as the bird, object as subject, subject as object. Simple examples from the world of birds should at least suggest that our grounds for being confident here that we are getting this right, that when we engage in the activity of trying to see as another and feel that we are successful in that enterprise, is not as robust as we might at first think. We need to take care here to identify when we are talking of error and when we are talking of differences in kind. Error must of necessity involve us having a correct position in principle. An example would be a situation where we feel we have some insight into the life of the bird, and further investigation or observation shows our view to be incorrect. The robin singing in the garden in autumn becomes our robin. We identify with him as our bird and readily recall his presence from last year. After all, he was in the habit of taking mealworms from the hand, and once again, as the days cool, he reappears and readily takes the proffered meal. But this is not the same bird. Ringing studies, particularly color ringing studies, have enriched our observational data here immeasurably. We now know that both male and female robins will sing in the autumn. We know that the turnover in garden birds is high, and birds we think of as ours are actually different individuals of the same species using the same habitat. Robins are both resident and migrants, some wintering as far south as North Africa. Many individuals reach our shores each autumn from Scandinavia, for example, and occupy territories alongside resident breeders. We also now know that small bird mortality in the first year is very high, and while some birds are long-lived, the oldest robin was nearly 8 years, 5 months, a typical lifespan is not more than 2 years. So we reevaluate based on our updated knowledge and think afresh about the life of a familiar species. But the improvement, or more neutrally, the enhancement of our knowledge of the bird is of course only the latest point on a process of continuous discovery. We know a lot more than we once did, but we are not prepared to say in principle that we now know all there is to know. We can readily accept that in principle here, the gathering and revising that we engage in can and will continue as long as we are prepared to take an interest. Because this process is continuous, and because we have discovered very readily that some apparently incontrovertible beliefs are ill-founded, we should exercise caution in our attempts to see as another. There is a difference in kind here, as it does not prove possible for us, in principle, to identify what would be right. We might say provisionally that this is what the exercise might look like, but we can never collate the facts in a definite way and then undertake our exercise of looking through the eyes of the bird. In both of these ways, then, our knowledge is provisional. There are sources of error, and we recognize that the very possibility of further error, of never being able to put that particular justified true belief on the pedestal, means we are, in principle, unable to look at the world in the way that a bird will. The argument here can be taken further. Where we look at differences of degree between ourselves and a bird, we are tempted into overconfidence and all too readily look at the world through the eyes of the bird. But where we reflect on more fundamental differences, such as migratory navigation using magnetic fields, or mate selection in blue tits by using the ultraviolet part of the electromagnetic spectrum, we might be inclined to accept for the time being that there is an insurmountable obstacle to the effort. Having come this far, we can rest on this insight to help in our efforts to tackle another instance of seeing as another. Transcendental idealism, in the form developed by Schopenhauer after Kant, builds on Kant's work in the Critique of Pure Reason. We might say that Schopenhauer, in typically bold terms, compresses and ultimately strengthens Kant's thesis, moving it from observations about the limitations of pure reason to a quasi-logical statement about space, time, and causality. An example of this reworking from the world of birds, or more particularly, the modern-day exercise of bird study, is what we call the theory of evolution. In contemporary accounts, such as Daniel Dennett's, evolution becomes not an hypothesis about how the world came to be what it is, but instead is an algorithm or cluster of algorithms telling us what always happens when we have competition for resources, successive generations, and variation giving rise to an advantage. We have evolution by natural selection. Reflection on the original count is characterized by Darwin and Wallace, informed by the modern understanding of genetics, has allowed scholars like Dennett to take accounts rich in observational detail and recharacterize them in ways which move away from the data, yet illuminate and enrich our understanding. Schopenhauer's reworking of Kant, which informs all of the world as will and representation, can be seen as originating in the extended critique in the appendix to book one of that text. It characterizes the transcendental idealism of the first critique, the Critique of Pure Reason, in the same kind of way. The world is representation, and the building blocks that make up that world, space, time, and causality, while providing tools, if you will, for building an extraordinarily rich and diverse world for us, at the same time set radical limits on what we can, as a matter of principle, be, of what can, as a matter of principle, be an object of perception. We can no more perceive outside this framework as we could fly unaided from here to Cameroon to overwinter. But we can be stronger than this, and by now this should not be surprising. On this view, the kind of view that we see in Schopenhauer after Kant, it is simply misconceived to talk of perception at all outside of the space, time, and causality framework. Because the world of perception is determined by our perceptual apparatus, and in a more profound way, by space, time, and causality, this cannot be all that there is. And Brian McGee puts it in this way from his text on the philosophy of Schopenhauer. He says, quote, "Our perceptions and conceptions cannot be all that there is, but cannot be like what exists in addition to them. So what else there is cannot consist of an independently existing world which corresponds to them. However, since they constitute the limits of what we can envisage, we cannot form any notion of what there is besides." End quote. This leaves room to posit an endless array of things outside of this world, despite the knowledge that we can no more strike them down than we can properly describe what they might be. Amongst other things, this should lead us towards a proper humility. We see that we operate with tools, limited by design, as it were, so we must exercise caution when we contemplate or examine a metaphysical account. The dotterel is a plover, a wading bird, wintering in the Mediterranean and breeding in small numbers in Scotland. In breeding plumage, the bird is a riot of rich reds, gold, and buff. It breeds on high montane plateaus, the typical whaleback hills of the Cairngorm Massif. Scientific study of such a bird in this type of remote habitat is hard and arduous, but dedicated workers have rewarded us with insight into their lives. The female, the more brightly colored of the pair, lays the eggs and then leaves the male to incubate and look after the chicks. Ringing studies have shown, quite astonishingly, that some females then travel further north to Norway, where they breed with another male, leaving that second male to travel south to its wintering grounds after the chicks have fledged. Simple observation alone, while providing us with rich and memorable experiences, does not allow us to begin to grasp what it is this species actually gets up to, the simplest level at which we reflect on other species' lives. Detailed observation, armed with rigor and discipline, reveal to us aspects of their lives that really challenge our ability to think or see as them. We might argue, as we have here, that this is the first stage to our recognizing that we have an in-kind obstacle to that activity. This is interesting in itself, but it is also helpful as an analogy or heuristic device when we try to grasp what transcendental idealism might mean, and to assimilate what this might mean to us in practice. In her study of Kant's first critique, Ray Langton describes this stance as epistemic humility. The Kantian account, to which Schopenhauer responds, reveals the limits of the human perspective, of human knowledge. However, it also indicates the very receptivity of human knowledge, that we are, and I quote from her, "we are receptive creatures who must be affected by things of which we have come to have knowledge." Langton argues that on Kant's view, such receptivity actually follows from epistemic humility. In Kant and Schopenhauer, then, we find ways to grasp the limits of our knowledge, but also how such limits, rather than constituting dead ends, become openings for developing a less arrogant epistemic perspective. Our seeing as the bird, we might say, does indeed give us insight into the human condition, as Lady Macbeth's Raven foretold. Thank you.